Hello, I'm James Thompson, Senior Chanticleer columnist at the Australian Financial Review.
And I'm Stephen Mayne, contributor, your intelligent investor, founder of Crikey, shareholder advocate and City of Manningham councillor.
And we are
the Money Cafe without Alan Kohler.
The virtual cafe remote
and lacking any Coca-Cola present.
I have a awful feeling, Stephen, that the inmates have taken over the asylum here. But I'm going to put that to one side and we'll be our usual professional selves.
And I was thinking that a couple of middle-aged white men like us on International Women's Day, if we'd been thinking fast, we'd have slotted in a couple of female hosts on this very important day.
Good point.
But instead, I think we should acknowledge the day. Interesting on this day, Nikki Haley's pulled out. Sam Kerr's facing race charges. Brittany Higgins is back in hospital. So it hasn't been a great start to International Women's Day, but the federal government policy on topping up paid paternity leave, I think, is a really good policy to announce on a day like today.
Absolutely. I actually asked my wife last week when all the gender pay stuff came out, what do you want to see on International Women's Day? And her company, funnily enough, has organised morning tea and a, would you believe this, a nail painting station, to which she is deeply unimpressed. But I guess the good thing is that this superannuation issue is the exact one she wanted some action on. So I think this will go down really well in the electorate, as it should.
I agree. And at City of Manningham, we had the legendary sports reporter Caroline Wilson speaking at our International Women's Day breakfast this morning, which was good.
Oh, cool. That would have been great.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great day. And we've got a question later on. We can probably cover it off now on the, what value the gender pay disclosure. And my only comment is I do love name and shame. A lot of people are driven by reputation, league ladders, what are the competitors doing, what are people saying at the golf club about us. So as long as the data is reliable, name and shame on companies and differential pay is really good. And if someone's going to argue it's apples and oranges, it's unfair, well, let the company explain it, that our sector is, female-centric in childcare or whatever. But put the data out there, put the names to the data, and it will improve outcomes, no doubt about it.
I think, Stephen, the very fact that we had a question about gender pay gap, it shows why you put the data out. It starts a conversation. It makes people say, okay, well, these are the structural barriers in my industry. Maybe there's not enough female graduates coming through the right university courses. And then you can stop and say, okay, well, why is that? What structural problems do we need to solve? So I think the release of this data, a bit of naming and shaming doesn't hurt, but it gets the conversation going. And too many of these structural unfairness with the deck stacked against women, we just sort of accept it and becomes background noise. So put it at the front, put some sunlight on it, and lo and behold, we start talking about it.
Look, I agree. You are what you measure. I mean, women on boards, we talked about it for years, but it never really got fixed in the ASX 300 until the companies had to report it in their annual reports.
Yes.
And as soon as they had to say, we've got seven blokes and one woman and, why? And then a few instos started saying we're going to start voting against. And then it got fixed and there's no all-male boards in the ASX 300 anymore, which is a good thing.
A good thing. Stephen, the big economic news this week was GDP. The slowest growth since 1992, with a few, ifs, if you take out the pandemic and if you take out the GST change. I guess I've got two reactions here, Stephen. One is that if it feels tough out there, that's because it is, particularly on a per capita basis. This isn't a pretty result. The other thing is that my other reflection would be that markets don't care. I mean, Japanese stock market, we've all been talking for the last few weeks about it, how it's at all-time highs. European stock markets are all-time highs. Japan's in a recession. Europe's pretty close to it. The market's looking through all this, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did love your line in your Chanticleer column on this about stock markets are melting up to record highs. I mean, normally they melt down, but everyone's hurting and stock markets are going up. So a new phrase, melting up. And it's correct. I mean, there's a lot of pain out there, but the market is just pricing in more and more central bank rate cuts. The Commonwealth Bank's now saying 3 for this year. And it's just the pricing on the interest rate power and reaffirming just how super impactful all these rate rises have been and how super powerful central banks are in equity market pricings, because it's the number one factor that drives the valuations.
Yeah, there's a pivot though here for Jim Chalmers, isn't there? He's been very rightly gung-ho on getting inflation down and the seriousness of that. Inflation's coming down pretty rapidly now, and he can see, oh, there might be a bit of a growth issue coming here as well. So it's a delicate balance.
Oh, I completely agree. And I have to say, the other stat I loved in your column was retirement benefit payments were $147 billion for the quarter, which was a record. And that just points to the record inequality in Australia, the fact that the elderly have got so much of the cash and the capital. And whilst the mortgage belts are hurting and cost of living and meat prices soaring, people who are in the retirement phase are helping into their super and their asset base to a record degree, and that is keeping the economy pumping.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's an amazing – these are amazing numbers. George Theriault, the economist at UBS, he's watching this really closely because he thinks, you know, this isn't just a 2024 story. This is going to be happening for decades because of the size of the retirement system. There's going to be a lot of – that's a big, big, big pool of money to draw on, and it's going to be interesting to see how it's spent.
Yeah, look, I couldn't agree. And the other thing with rising – stock markets all over the world is this dichotomy about the lack of new floats. And the ASX had their monthly February data out yesterday for new listings, and it was the 13th month in a row where there's been more delistings than new listings. So they had 6 new listings in February, 10 delistings. So we're now down to 2,183. We've lost a net 111 listed entities in the last 13 months, and I can't recall a time we've had 13 months in a row of declines in the number of listed stocks at a time when markets are at record high.
Yeah, so great point.
I guess it's just the drought of floats and the record takeovers coming through, and we're just seeing a thinning out of the ASX ranks in the middle of a market boom.
Which goes to a point I know you've spoken about recently on the podcast about the takeovers binge we're seeing. It's mainly being driven by foreign entities coming over here and snapping up some storied Australian names. You've spoken about CSR and Boral before.
Costa and Boat Longyear are the two that have already gone this year in terms of we've voted as shareholders. There's another 10 deals announced with this incredible focus on building products. I mean, CSR, Alumina, Boral, Adbri, all in the takeover throes. And I did really like your column the other day about Boral, whether the independent directors, the three of them, get together and actually recommend again Perry Stokes' attempt to opportunistically mop it up with a few if you don't take the offer, it'll be hell for you type failed threats thrown in there. A very interesting issue about a billionaire up against independent directors and 55,000 retail shareholders in Boral waiting for the advice as to whether hand over their stock even more to the billionaire Stokes or hang in there for a higher price following what the independent directors may or may not say.
Going to be a very interesting call for the independent directors there. It's tough to resist the force when the force owns 76% of the company, but they might make a stand there. Stephen, it's a sort of weird time of the corporate calendar where we've had February reporting season. We now go into a little mini AGM season. You've been out on the hustings again?
Well, it's interesting. It's a mini AGM season coming up in April and May, but I was actually going to comment to you that March is, I think it's the third quietest month of the year. So the quietest month of the year is January. The second quietest month of the year is July. And the next quietest is March, because we don't have that many AGMs in April and May from December 12 companies. But I do also want to reflect on the busiest day of the year so far, which was February 29, the last day of the reporting season.
We had
250 companies reported on the last day, and close to 200 of them were losses. So it's very cynical the way these 10% of listed stocks wait until the last day and try to escape any scrutiny by releasing their profits. So in order to send a message to all of them, I wanted to mention the very last company on that day. It was a company called Sight International. They waited until 8:22 p.m. We've got three blokes on the board. They're based in Brisbane. They're in the education and training space at a training colleges. They're currently, their Philippines campus is currently training up riggers and scaffolders for the Snowy River scheme. They released an $815,000 loss at 8:22 p.m. on February 29, and they now have accumulated losses of $89 million.
Right.
So we go from the busiest day of the year to a very quiet month, and the only AGM I've had recently was Aristocrat.
How was that?
And I have to give them credit because it went for 1 hour and 50 minutes. Oof. They ran a fully virtual, so they ran a full hybrid AGM. They didn't censor or edit any of my questions. Neil Chatfield, the chair, allowed them all to be read out in full. The CEO, Trevor Croker, gave the best ever answer to my tell us about your share bonus trading history, investing history. And he laid it out in full. He currently owns $32 million worth of shares. And Aristocrat shares since the AGM have soared to a record of $47 on Friday, and the market cap has almost hit $30 billion.
Wow.
Only four of us bothered to ask questions at the AGM, even though there's more than 40,000 shareholders. So it just shows that the AGM is dead from an attendance point of view, but at least Aristocrat, I don't like the gambling, obviously, but at least they answered all the questions, unlike the likes of Santos or Twiggy Forrest or Kerry Stokes, who don't allow online questions and therefore suppress debate at their AGMs.
Well, you don't need too many questions when things are going so well, do you, Stephen?
Well, no, you don't. I mean, but, you know, I still like to always put them through their paces. And one question I did ask the chairman, Neil Chatfield, was whether he was offered the Qantas chairman's job because was the long-term chair of Virgin Australia.
Yes,
and obviously with coal and logistics, he had a long career at Toll. He actually would have been a good choice. He's just a bit dour, and you need someone who's a bit of a charmer and can work the politicians for that Qantas chair role. And John Mullen, I think, fits the bill slightly better. But look, Aristocrat, it's up there now, I think, with Macquarie, WiseTech, Goodman, CSL, and Cochlear as the best genuine international, global, Australian success stories, not sitting back like the big four banks or the big supermarkets and just gouging Australians, actually making, you know, 93% of Aristocrat's revenue now comes from offshore, you know, social gaming, real money gaming, and it's just an incredible story. They're worth more than, you know, Lottery Corp, Endeavour, and what Crown sold for combined, which were the other three big gaming companies.
Now you think about those names that you just went through, Stephen. Not only are they all global, they all have a what's the right word? They all have a passion for reinvestment. They pump money back into their products, into R&D to try and keep finding the next thing. It is another thing that sets good companies apart, I reckon.
Yeah, no, I agree. They are. I mean, we need as many as possible. We're losing too many stocks for takeovers, so we need great global Australian success stories. And look, before we get to questions, I've been reading some of your columns. I don't know how you pump out so many columns in the most prestigious page in the country on the back of the Fin Review, but your private hospitals versus the private insurers I thought was interesting. I was amazed to see how many private hospitals have gone from making profits to making losses. We're starting to see closures. And surely we can't have private hospitals closing just from a system capacity point of view.
We don't want it, no. I mean, this is usually the private health insurers and the private hospitals are at each other's throats, and because whoever gets the bigger slice of the profit pie, you know, the other is the loser. But the clear winner has been private health insurers really since COVID, which obviously really disrupted the private hospitals' businesses, and they just haven't recovered. You know, there's a few structural changes in the way we do healthcare. So there's a lot more day surgeries, which rather than long hospital stays, which is good for patients, right? But it's means less revenue for hospitals. We're even seeing more in-home care, where cancer treatments and those sort of things can be done in home. So there's a, you know, there's a complicated structural and cyclical factors to think about, but I think even the private health insurers are realizing that they might need to share a bit more of the profit pie with the private hospital operators. I mean, there's about 650 private hospitals in the country. We've seen 22 closures of either hospitals or hospital units.
Wow.
partly that's to do with the birth rate falling post-COVID back to more normal levels. So there's a little bit more, a little bit less need for maternity services. But yeah, only 30% of private hospitals are breaking even or profitable. That's not a great number. So
no,
yeah.
No.
All right, Stephen.
An interesting struggle.
Before we get to questions, here's a quick word from our sponsor.
Is it time to brush up on your investing skills and knowledge? Well, InvestSmart's Investor Bootcamp is for you. Learn the fundamentals of investing, how to form better money habits, and what it takes to build long-term wealth. Do it at your own pace over 3 months, with the option to participate in live weekly webinars to consolidate your learning. Usually $99, Money Cafe listeners can get $40 off with the code MONEY40. Visit investsmart.com.au/bootcamp and use MONEY40 to save $40.
Okay, welcome back. Stephen, I'm going to start. John says solar panels, batteries and wind turbines have limited life expectancy. Why does Australia have no facilities to deal with them at the end of life, say before 2040 to 2050? What are the hazards of recycling them? Is there any science or evidence about this? Stephen, it's not an easy thing to sort out, is it?
Well, it's not an easy thing to sort out, but I'm actually going to take on John at the core level. This is a classic sort of bait and switch debating tactic, you know, like when someone says, did you fly on a plane to go to your climate conference? So you hypocrite, how many carbon miles did you burn up? You know, so at City of Manningham, we had 1,300 people booked in on Saturday to come to our e-waste collection day. They lined up in their cars with everything from paint to batteries to electricals to CDs, and solar panels, batteries and wind turbines are just one of thousands of products that will have to be sensibly recycled as best as possible. But it's the fact that they might be difficult or challenging at some elements is not an argument to delay the energy transition. And so I think that we shouldn't actually get into that debate directly. Just say it will be dealt with like every other product. And they're not particularly short life products. It's not as if you're opening a battery every second day to turn the power. I mean, These things do last for decades. It's not a one use product.
To reassure John, there are people thinking about this, though. At his press club speech recently, Andrew Forrest announced that he would create a recycling fund for wind turbines at his private company, Squadron Energy. So it is an issue, a question out there with people, and you know, rest assured, John, they are the renewable industry is thinking about it.
Yeah, but it's nowhere near as big a challenge as, for instance, the plastics industry, which is 50 times more challenging and damaging in terms of a recycling issue than renewable energy products. Now, Rob is interested in the fact that we had a call or a questioner last week complaining about double rates by the Sunshine Coast Council.
Yeah.
And is talking about whether, you know, councils are levelling the playing field by levying differential rates depending on the use of land. And I must admit, as a local government councillor, I will say that the rating system is very interesting. At the City of Manningham, we proudly do not have any differential rates. So when I was a City of Melbourne councillor, we slugged business 17% more than we slugged our residential ratepayers. But many councils, the vast majority of regional councils, have a farm rate, and in Victoria that can be as little as one quarter of the average rate. So most councils have heavily discounted farm rates. And at the end of the day, rates are a wealth tax based on the value of your property. The more bigger your mansion, the more rates you will pay. That's why I really like it as a tax, unlike land tax, which, you know, only hits land and the family home is exempt, unlike stamp duty, which unfairly targets people who are moving home or transactions of property as opposed to people who just hold their property for 30 years. But in terms of the councils putting on extra rates on investors and things, it is happening. It's difficult to administer because you've got to get in there and big brother-like work out whether there's a family living there or whether it's an investment property. There is too many Airbnbs and not enough long-term rentals out there, and I support the likes of Bass Coast Council or Mornington Peninsula having a bit of a levy to try and deal with the tourism costs and also try and send a small price signal that maybe long-term rentals is better in terms of challenging and dealing with the housing affordability crisis.
There is a follow-up question there, Stephen, from David that I might get you to address too. And I guess his point is that his argument is that the tenancy law, particularly in New South Wales, is quite weighted in the favour of tenants. And he says it always makes his blood boil when he hears the likes of the tenant union moaning about how tenants are hard done by and looking for further rights. To your point about the wealth tax and, you know, it's terrifically hard out there being a tenant at the moment with the vacancy rate so low, and while David might be a great landlord, others aren't so good. How do we get the balance right here? Is there a way... Do we need to be careful about the balance? Because we do want a healthy number of rentals, and that requires a healthy number of landlords.
Yeah, look, I agree. I mean, the biggest single problem is the price. And so I think that to fix it, you know, there's the Max, the Greens guy, Max, is talking about, you know, negative gearing and all those things. I actually agree with them that any subsidies which draw investors in and drive up the price, that's the fundamental challenge with housing affordability. And the second fundamental challenge is the lack of supply in an environment of relatively elevated immigration. And so we do need governments directly building more supply. And then on the rental situation, I agree that the balance is right. New South Wales sounds like they might have tilted a little bit too far one way, but it is more lucrative to do the Airbnb thing. So I do actually support taxes and regulations which will tilt the incentives back slightly towards the longer-term rental situation. But the rental tenancy laws are not going to deal with the fundamental issue, which is we need more houses, we need more supply, and at affordable prices, because the prices are just too high, elevated by the tax incentives in the system.
Hmm. Steve mentions last week on the podcast, we talked about how much land is needed for various forms of renewable energy. And Steve sent us in some information about wind farms, solar. I just wanted to call out two points he makes. And one is that if the land had a sort of higher agricultural value, then renewable energy developers simply wouldn't be able to afford it. So that is an interesting point about how we think about the value of the of agricultural land versus its use for renewable. And the other point he makes is the mob he works for is running a trial around to show that land under solar panels is more productive from a grazier's perspective.
Wow. He's claiming the sheep are healthier and the wool is better if you're grazing near solar panels. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing this
data
come out. If that's true, wow. I mean, that's going to be an interesting claim. But, I mean, I'm sick of the rubbish claims against renewables, like farmers saying it's going to take away good productive agricultural land. I mean, it's going to be at the maximum, wind farms are the best of all. They only use about 3% of the underlying land. You can graze cattle, you can do stuff underneath the wind farm. Solar are a bit more intensive, but even if you fully build out all of our renewable needs, as Steve makes in his question, it's only about 120,000 hectares nationally. That's about the same as the current land use for coal mines all over the country. And we're currently land clearing at the rate of 250,000 hectares a year, mostly for agriculture. So it's just a tiny amount. And most wind farms are built along ridge lines or on poor quality farmland. So this idea that this huge nation is suddenly not going to have enough farmland because there's too many solar panels and wind farms everywhere, come on.
Nicely said, Stephen. It's it's still an issue, clearly, that is out there, but it does need some facts, and that's a good lot of facts. I love this from Karen, who says, "Greetings, Money Cafe from the hills of Adelaide, where cucumber supply is robust, but tomato futures are looking lousy in Karen's vegetable garden." Now, this was a discussion that you and Alan had, Stephen, about where tips go in the hospitality sector. And she says there is, to summarise, that there's generally no sort of strict rules about this, and it's Difficult to figure out sometimes where the tips end up. Are they saved for the Christmas party? Do they just disappear? Does management just bank them? I think this is a – we might need a Royal Commission into this.
Look, you know, at a time, Labor governments, you know, and we've got Labor governments everywhere except Tasmania, because the Labor Party is 50% controlled by their affiliated unions, you always see Labor governments, you know, dive heavily into industrial relations law writing.
Yes.
And, you know, the don't call at home, you know, is the latest one where you can probably argue, you know, was it really necessary? I don't think there's going to be any fair work actions about, you know, Johnny, you know, the boss called me at home three times. This is outrageous. But on this issue, I actually do think there might be a case for some precise legislation on the handling of tips, because clearly with the eating out revolution and with the movement away from cash, it has become quite blurred. And I think that people who are intending to leave tips for the waitstaff they dealt with, clearly from the anecdotal evidence now coming in from multiple Money Cafe correspondents, a lot of the cash is being pocketed by the venue, the bosses. The systems are unclear. The practice is all over the place. And maybe a little bit of regulatory clarity is required here.
Oof, I can see you going to war with the Australian Industry Group or the Small Business Council over that, Stephen, but I don't disagree. Maybe even just a common sense ruling from someone would be helpful.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful. Now, Michael was interested in the recent nuclear power discussion you had. He's recommending a Blinham Partners podcast for 2 hours by Dr. Addie Patterson. I think in terms of just throwing in my two bobs worth on your nuclear debate, I agree with Alan on the need to lift the ban. It's a pointless, useless, ridiculous ban. And I agree with Twiggy Forrest that nuclear will never happen because of the economics. And I also agree with Twiggy Forrest at the Press Club that Gina Rinehart is a climate denier. And I'm puzzled why she's calling for nuclear, and I'm puzzled why her obedient and a very obliging favourite opposition leader, Peter Dutton, in between flying across the country to attend her birthday events, is also going all in on nuclear when the economics of these small modular plants is falling all over the world.
As a local councillor, Stephen, you would get to see some NIMBYism up front. What do you reckon the NIMBYism when your suburb's chosen as the site for a nuclear reactor under Dutton's plan is going to be like?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously it's not going to happen in the suburbs of Melbourne. We've got our 1,400 private tennis courts in Manningham, all of which could host a
small modular reactor.
They are about as big as, you know, a shipping container. I mean, they are pretty small. So logically, you would put them where there is current transmission capacity, and that would be on existing closed coal mining and coal-powered sites, a bit like how many of them are getting giant batteries being built. So I've no problems with running the economics on putting them in sensible places in industrial zones a long way away from residents. But it just seems that everyone is saying that the economics doesn't work because Australia has so much wind and solar, we just do not need to go the nuclear route like the French and others. But if Dutton wants to debate this just because Gina's told him to, well, good luck, Dutton. I don't think he's going to win you too many votes.
No, I agree with that. It's a weird one. We've got a question here from Gavin who says, my question is, financial commentators, economists and others do a great job of sharing, analysing data, but no one seems to dig deeper. His problem is that the CPI data is measured against a sample of basket of goods and their weightings in that basket. He reckons our weightings now are out of date and irrelevant. For example, housing is weighted at 23% of the market. The reality, it's more likely to be 50% of a family's expense. Stephen, I reckon the ABS would be right on top of this and paying very close attention to it. What's your sense?
I agree. I would say, look, leave it to the experts. You know, I always get a bit tired when people start, you know, challenging the core fundamentals of something because they don't like what the something is showing. So people obviously are not enjoying, you know, the high CPI data, and then, you know, they come out and say, oh, it's, you know, it's worse for us than what the data is showing. And does this mean that pollies are deliberately trying to understate CPI? It's a bit like, you know, I mean, I don't like the fact that 1 hour of work is deemed to be employment in terms of the employment levels. I also don't like the fact that CEO salaries are reported in pre-tax terms when often they pay 50% in tax, and they should be reported in post-tax terms, just like corporate profits are reported in post-tax terms. So overall, I'm sure the statistical experts have this in hand, that like the ASX 300, which has adjustments and ins and outs, that they will tweak the data from time to time to accurately reflect, you know, lived experience of inflation in Australia.
All right, we've got time for a couple more. I'm going to jump to Alan's question, Stephen. Overseas companies are flocking to take over the Australian listed companies. Feel the Australian dollar is undervalued. What can we do to stop flogging things off cheaply? Perhaps a minimum percentage above the usual share market value, e.g. 50% takeover tax surcharge. How do you think that'd go down?
That wouldn't fly very well. Look, along with the Brits, we do probably historically and currently have the most liberal foreign takeover regime in the world. I mean, there's no way that the Americans would let foreigners come in and buy up their ports and airports. You know, I mean, LAX is owned by Los Angeles City Council. So, you know, we shouldn't have sold off the Port of Darwin. Even on some takeovers, like I don't believe that Bellamy's, I do believe that sort of milk and powder products, you can argue there's a sort of a health imperative there. Whether that should have been snapped up by a Chinese entity with state links, you could run an argument for blocking that. I mean, over the years, the Singapore Stock Exchange was blocked from buying the ASX. Effectively, there's a ban on our big four banks being taken over. Woodside was not allowed to be taken over by Shell. But I do believe in let the market rip, but I do worry about the massively high number of takeovers at the moment. I do agree with the questioner that with our low dollar at the moment, it is relatively cheap to buy into Australia, but I'm not up for any form of sort of nationalistic you can't take over or poison pills. Like, you know, you can't take over many, you know, you can't buy Google, Facebook, yeah. News Corp, yeah. Because they've got dual class voting systems where the founders control 80% of the voted stock. That is just undemocratic. It's gerrymandered. So I'm proud of Australia's democratic one voting class. If you make a fair bid, you know, it will be dealt with seriously, but it's just sad that there's so many takeovers at the moment and we're not producing more international champions like the WiseTechs and the aristocrats of the world.
Yeah, good call. All right, well, thanks. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks for listening to today's episode of The Money Cafe. Alan will be back next week with myself, so send a question in and we'll do our best to answer it together by emailing themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. Until then, I'm James Thompson, Senior Chanticleer Columnist at the Australian Financial Review.
And I'm Stephen Mayne, Contributor, Intelligent Investor, Founder of Crikey Shareholder Advocate and City of Manningham Councillor, and I'll be back with Coca-Cola in a fortnight.